This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. The National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, or NASCAR, was born in 1947 when entrepreneur Bill France got the idea to organize the informal American pastime of people racing cars. The idea caught on in North Carolina, and at one time more than 26 NASCAR races were held here and in South Carolina. NASCAR became a fixed and beloved part of North Carolina's culture and an important part of the state's economy. But NASCAR itself has grown much bigger than North Carolina, and as NASCAR looks to conquer markets in other states and abroad, racetracks in North Carolina have closed. Today, we're looking at the future of NASCAR in North Carolina. Do you see bright times ahead for one of North Carolina's favorite pastimes, or are you disturbed by the trend of tracks closing and races leaving the state? We welcome your calls this hour, 1-877-962-9862. And we're joined now by Scott Hewler, author of A Little Bit Sideways, 1 Week Inside a NASCAR Winston Cup Race Team. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Thanks. And Ed McLean is also with us by phone from Cornelius, North Carolina, near Charlotte. Ed McLean is Executive Director of the North Carolina Motorsports Association. Welcome, Ed.
Hey, thank you, Rusty.
And Ed, I'm going to ask you to explain to us how the Carolinas became almost the primary home and hotbed for the sport of sport of NASCAR.
Well, I think it actually started by accident. There was no great plan. It's just, some of the legendary stories about moonshine and the things that relate to that. Some people don't like to talk to it. I think with the change in the sponsorship rules this year, allowing some of the beverage companies to come back in, sends us back to our roots almost. But it just grew up out here in the country. And Bill France and some others thought that if it was organized, these guys could put a show on and people would pay to come see it. I think it was that simple. And it was because of these cars running the back roads and trying to outrun the revenuers that it got to be so popular here in this state.
And people are paying fistfuls, right?
Yes.
North Carolina and the Carolinas gave birth to some of NASCAR's most famous drivers. Is that right?
Oh, yes.
And who were some of them?
The Cale Yarbroughs, if you go down to South Carolina, David Pearson, Cale Yarbrough, Richard Petty up here, the Earnharts, which goes back to Ralph Earnhardt, and then Dale Sr., and now you got, just like at the Petties, you got third generation with Dale Jr. out there.
And don't forget Junior Johnson.
Oh, Junior.
Yes, yeah, Scott Hewler, I want to turn to you to hear a bit about how you even became a NASCAR fan, because I don't think you started that one. But before that, just what do you know, or what's your sense of why the Carolinas, why North Carolina is this hotbed of NASCAR, and was the right place for NASCAR to kind of reach its peak?
Well, there's a few things going on in North Carolina. One of them is red clay, is what North Carolina is made of. It's literally in the ground we walk on. The red clay that you get here makes a great racetrack, and dirt track racing is where NASCAR got started. It didn't even run on a paved speedway until Darlington opened in 1950, and so that was really important. Another thing, as we were just hearing, it was those bootleggers that here there was such a strong bootleg trade, and the bootleggers would have to come up with different cars for different problems. When you were getting your product from the still down the mountain, you had to have a car that would handle turns well. And of course, this had to be a powerful car that could carry a lot of weight, but it would have to handle turns well. And then when you were down and you were trying to get into the city, you'd have to have a fast car. It just had to be flat out fast. And then once you were in the city distributing, you had to have a car that could start up quick, stop quick, and turn, make right and left turns quick. So you kind of had what amounted to crew chiefs eventually setting up different cars in different ways so that they could outrun the revenue agents and so that they could get where they were going quickly and solve the problems that the bootleggers had. Then naturally what happens in a place like this is people start saying, well, my car so fast outran this sheriff or this revenue agent at that time, and then somebody else says, oh, my car's just as fast, and before you know it, some farmer's plowing up his field, making what they used to call a bull ring, a little quarter-mile red clay dirt track, and then Friday night, Saturday night, everybody shows up to see who's fastest, and they'll pay a little bit, and they'll drink a little bit, and they'll have a little fun, and usually the person organizing the race who was saving up the saving up the prize money, would leave before the race was over. And whoever won didn't get their prize money, and that's where people like the Frances came in to actually organize this, what was essentially an outlaw sport, and bring it into the light of day so that people could come on Sunday after church and see something that they could be proud of.
And Ed McLean, this is one of the links that NASCAR has between its fans and the people who are the performers of the sport. These are stock cars. These are models of cars that everyday people drive to and from the train stations, to and from work, with maybe just a little more under the hood.
A lot more under the hood. and the resemblance to the stock car is in silhouette only just about now. These cars are hand-fabricated. Today, now, when I got involved back 30 years ago, you were right on the edge. They had just quit using, I think it was in 1964, 67, they literally used a streetcar and modified it completely, and then they started, for safety reasons, building stronger chassis and roll cages built into the cars in the mid-60s, and that's when things took off and were able to go to faster speeds and still be relatively safe, but not safe by today's standards at all. Safety has really evolved, and the cars are pretty much hand-built, and they're even hand-built around a particular driver.
Scott, today we're talking about NASCAR and its maturation and perhaps migration. Talk a bit about the connection. What draws you to NASCAR? Because this is really, we're talking about fans. Maybe fans in the Carolinas losing a grip on the sport they've thought of as theirs for a long time. What drew you to NASCAR?
Well, Russell, what drew me to it was that NASCAR has what no other actual sport, no other pro sport has anymore. Whether NASCAR is going to have it in 5 years, I don't know. But NASCAR was real. When I stumbled upon NASCAR, when I moved down here in 1992, I was just another dumb Yankee moving down in North Carolina who didn't know anything. And Carlton Tudor at the News and Observer got the idea that it would be fun to send me out to Charlotte to live on the infield. As you know, race fans don't just go to races. They live there for 3 or 4 days. They live in many racetracks. They actually set up camp on the infield so that they're literally in the middle of the action. The action is taking place around them. And Toot thought it would be fun for me to go and live there and write a story. And I think it was meant to be a point-and-laugh story where I was going to come back and make fun of the bellies, boots, and beards crowd. And the exact opposite happened. I showed up, and I had never seen anything like this. The depth of the culture, the experience, the profundity of what NASCAR had to offer. It was loud. It was exciting. The connection between the fans and the teams was absolutely staggering, and I had never seen anything like it. And I never wanted to leave. I was ecstatic from the moment that I walked on the infield at Charlotte, and I wanted to chronicle that. I wanted to learn more and more about what drew people in. Why did people love this sport so much? And one of the reasons it was at that point was connection with the drivers. Every race that you went to, drivers would be sitting around for free, signing autographs, meeting and greeting the fans. Drivers, it was a commonplace. If you were looking to interview a driver and you were going to a race in Darlington, say, that the driver might say, well, I can't talk to you Friday night. There's a family that I know in Darlington. They always have a cookout for us when we go to Darlington, and we'll go down and you know, stand around their charcoal grill and have food with them. Now, I don't think that's happening anymore, but even in the early 90s, that was still happening. There was still an unbelievable connection between the teams and the fans. The fans felt like they knew the drivers, and they felt like they were friends with the drivers. There was a kind of branding going on where now, you know, you root for, say, the Panthers, right, in Charlotte or something like that. You're just rooting basically for a color scheme, right? Because the players come and go. The team will leave if it decides it's worth it. The team's going to hold up the town for a new stadium for sure sometime in the next 10 years. They all do. It's hard to feel real good about it. At that point 10 years ago, you still felt like you knew who these drivers were, and they stood for something. They had values. They meant something to people.
Ed McLean, this is a very intimate picture of the fan and his or her connection to the sport. Before we get into how that intimacy might be affected by the growth that's happening in NASCAR, what evidence is there that the Carolinas is losing its grip on NASCAR? What's happening now in terms of races migrating and tracks being closed?
I would dare to disagree with you that we're losing our grip. Quite the opposite has happened from a business standpoint. Now, from a fan standpoint, the races have moved out to be closer to larger markets and to get to more people. That has gone on. As they've moved some of them out west more. It used to be considered a southwest or southeast sport. They're even looking in the northwest of putting something, but they've gone up into New England, the Poconos, you know, New Jersey. They're looking in New York. But there's a core business that is built here in North Carolina. And that's what I spent the last year working with Dr. Connaughton at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte doing an economic impact study. And with even the loss of the Rockingham race in North Wilkesboro, there is an economic impact that we have now chronicled that's $5 billion here in North Carolina motorsports. Now, that's made up mostly or largely of NASCAR-related businesses. But in addition to that, there's drag racing, there's kart racing, there's all the things that where these guys have to come through the chairs of learning how to be a cup, Nextel Cup, you know, racer.
Let me stop you there, Ed McLean. When we come back, I want to ask you, Scott Fuhler, if you agree that the intimacy is preserved no matter what the changes in NASCAR. This is The State of Things. We're talking about the future of NASCAR in North Carolina with Ed McLean, Executive Director of the North Carolina Motorsports Association, and Scott Fuhler, author of A Little Bit Sideways, 1 week inside a NASCAR Winston Cup race team. Taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. Thanks, and stay with us. We're talking today about the future of NASCAR in North Carolina. At one time, NASCAR held 26 races a year in North and South Carolina. Not anymore. NASCAR is now a worldwide sport with plans to expand in Canada, Mexico, and Europe. Scott Fuhler, author of A Little Bit Sideways, 1 week inside a NASCAR Winston Cup race team, is with us, as is Ed McLean, Executive Director of the North Carolina Motorsports Association. Scott Fuhler, we just heard Ed McLean talk about how business-wise things have never been better with NASCAR, and it's certainly a wildly popular sport approaching, I guess, football or some of the most popular spectator sports. But I'd like to ask you if you think something is being lost with the growth. And maybe you can also tell us about what changes have taken place in terms of races moving and tracks closing.
Well, I think something has been lost. I'm less sanguine than Ed is about the changes in the sport. I think as it has become, you know, NASCAR was always trying to position itself as the fifth major sport. I think with hockey on self-destruct, NASCAR is already the fourth major sport. And the NBA is probably going to fight itself out of existence pretty quick, too. I think NASCAR is incredibly popular, but it's not popular in the same way it was. In the Southeast, NASCAR, don't forget, until 1965, there were no pro sports in the Southeast. NASCAR was the Southeast's pro sport, and there was a relationship between the fans and the sport that was the envy of other sports. There was nothing like that, even, you know, 30 years later when I came down here. Now, when I moved down to Raleigh, 16 of the 32 at that time Winston Cup races were within about a 7-hour drive of my house in Raleigh, North Carolina. Now I think you can say that about 7 of them, and only 3 are left in the state of North Carolina. And we hear that the All-Star race that is run the week before the Coca-Cola 600 on Memorial Day is also possibly leaving, which that'll be a pitched battle between Bruton Smith of Charlotte and the France family. But I think that you see the power base shifting, partially because the Frances would like to see that happen, and partially because as the sport grows, it goes where the money is. And there's only so much money in the Carolinas, and I think that there is some motion away from the Carolinas. Now, there's still plenty of smaller time racing here, and I find, as a race fan, that it's a lot like NASCAR to me is a lot like baseball was in the 80s when people started rediscovering minor league baseball because the big game was getting inaccessible to them and too expensive, people started going in large numbers to the minor league ballparks to see what was going on. It was a lot more fun. You could take your kids. You could have a good time. It wasn't so expensive. And the players were a little bit more lively. I think you're finding the same thing to go to the Orange County Speedway, the Wake County Speedway. There's different places around here that you can see sort of beginning races that are really interesting.
Yeah, and McLean, is the migration of the Nextel Cup races, the kind of the major league of the racing sport, moving elsewhere? Is that a good sign for the Busch Series? And will NASCAR fans in North Carolina kind of take solace at the Busch Cup races the way people go to minor league ballparks to recapture some of that quaintness?
Well, that's part of it. But in addition to the Busch races, there's also the Truck Series. But then there are also 32 weekly racing series tracks here in North Carolina. And that's where the real roots of stock car racing are. And those run weekly shows, sometimes as many as 26 weekends a year. And that was part of what we were looking at, is where are the roots, where the next driver's coming from.
Right, and there's, I think that there's, I'd be interested to know, Ed, if you think that there's more and more interest showing up in there as the cup level and even the Busch level races get out of reach of a lot of the people who used to go to those races 10 or 15 years ago. They're a little too expensive for those people now. Are we seeing more fans showing up at Orange County Speedway or places like that?
Yes. And you go to Bowman Gray. We were talking about Bowman Gray Stadium. They've been running forever up there. They're one of the earliest tracks. They still put in, and they run, I think, about 14 or 16 weekends a year. And they put 7,000-8,000 people in there when they're open for their weekly racing series. There's the Hooters Cup, which is another type of an ARCA racing that comes down here. So there's lots of racing going on, and that's also one of the reasons NASCAR moved their research and development facilities here, is to be close to where the teams are, the drivers are here. There's talk from Mayor McCrory this week in the paper about renewed interest in a major motorsports type museum in Charlotte area of Mecklenburg County, the region, Charlotte region, that because it's a home of stock car racing and NASCAR, that like the Hall of Fame, like the Rock and Roll up in Cleveland, I guess it is, and over in Nashville, how they branded themselves Music City, do some of that here in North Carolina. I know I'm working with the governor in the governor's office and General Assembly on trying to figure out what the future of motorsports is in North Carolina.
Yeah, I wanted you to expand on that if you can, because racing is not the only way the state's trying to capitalize on the popularity of racing. Is that right? Can you tell us about some of the other ways that are being looked at?
Well, it's like if you were to visit our website, the Motorsport NCMA, and you would see that General Motors, Ford, and Toyota are corporate members, along with Wachovia and Lowe's Corporation. And part of what that is an interest in what we've identified here as an association, that there's some very talented people that understand automobiles, which gives us a direct bridge back to the automobile factories, which, says that, maybe they ought to look at locating in factories down here because of the talent and the workforce that's in North Carolina. It's a big effort to create jobs. Governor Easley and the General Assembly is very interested in anybody that has ideas about creating jobs. And one of the places we're weak is a big original equipment automobile manufacturing corporations. But we're also home to over 1,000 people, businesses that supply parts and pieces to the automobile industry. And that's been almost as well kept a secret as the motorsports industry and what's really, what businesses and jobs are really here.
Scott Hewler, I'm wondering if you could tell us about maybe some of the ways that NASCAR is changing, not just growing and expanding to newer markets, but what's happening to the cars. I mean, I know basketball over the years has altered rules to try to make high-scoring games, really draw in more popularity, make it great for television. Is NASCAR instituting any kind of changes like that to make it even more exciting to its fans?
fortunately, in my experience, I don't see much of that. You were talking about how a NASCAR racer is like a stock car with a little bit more under the hood, and it's a lot more. And one of the important things about a NASCAR racer is it has a lot less under the hood in certain ways. One of the things a NASCAR race car does not have is computers under the hood. You may not realize that. And it also has a carburetor, which you, if you stopped every car on I-40 for an hour, you probably wouldn't find a car that still had a carburetor in it. And the only specific thing that the NASCAR that NASCAR racers do to try to increase competitiveness is they have the restrictor plates on the super speedways, which slows down the cars. It's done basically to slow down the cars so that they're not flying, literally flying off into the stands when they get into wrecks. But it has the effect of keeping the cars very, very close and making extremely competitive and kind of terrifying races. But no, it seems like overall, though, they each year, if Ford or Chevy shows that their cars are winning a lot of races, then NASCAR will slightly change the rules for what the drivers of the other cars can do with their templates. But overall, one of the great things about NASCAR is they do let the teams take the basic car and just try to squeeze as much speed out of it as they can. That's one of the things that I think is really good about it. And the low-level cheating that's such a beloved part of the sport is part of the excitement of seeing what you can get, where you can find a gray area to exploit. So I like...
Still trying to outrun the revenue collectors.
Yeah, exactly. Only in this case, it's just it's your NASCAR officials that you're trying to outrun and trying to get over on. And that's part of... I think the fans love that. And I think...
Don't forget about the chase for the cup at the end of the season. The TV numbers were up over 50% this year, and it had all to do with restructuring so the fans would see an exciting finish on the season.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and it was hugely successful. It was unbelievably successful.
There was a huge risk out there. I think everybody would, you know, when you make a change, whether it be this sport or basketball or something, you know, but it's done in order to make it more interesting for the fans who ultimately are the base for the sport. Without the fans, there is no sport. And that's one thing the France family has recognized.
And Ed McLean, I just want to ask you one last question. We have to wrap up here after that. But in terms of new fans, are there programs to actually cultivate a crop of minority drivers and drivers from other demographic groups that might also help find new fans?
Yes, sir. And that's a very proactive program. We're working with Sam Belnavis. He's on our foundation board. He's with Roush Racing. He's a former car owner, and actually he owns part of Roush Racing now. And also Dr. Exum up at North Carolina A&T, who has a motorsports program there that's primarily a minority campus. And they are also working, A&T is working with Cabarrus Roanne Community College to get some involvement there.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, Ed McLean. Thanks so much to our guests. Scott Hueler is author of the book A Little Bit Sideways, 1 Week Inside a NASCAR Winston Cup Race Team, and most recently, Defining the Wind, the Beaufort Scale and How a 19th Century Admiral Turned Science into Poetry. And Ed McLean is the executive director of the North Carolina Motorsports Association. Thanks, gentlemen. Coming up, sociologist Michael Schwalbe introduces us to Reet and Shine. Stay with us.
Me and the guys at work got together, had to get us up a plan, so we won't miss a race this year. Lord, we're dedicated NASCAR fans. I scored an infield pass, and we all chipped in on gas, so they voted me director of
Sociologist Michael Schwalbe never expected to write a biography. Like most sociologists, he was accustomed to doing studies and drawing conclusions from cold data. Then he met Anthony Atwater and Matthew Mason, two very different African-American men living in and around Chapel Hill. Whereas Atwater was wily and streetwise, Mason was gentle, a pleasing entertainer. Both men were near the ends of their lives, so they moved slowly, needing canes or an oxygen tank. Michael Schwalbe was transfixed by the differences and similarities in their stories. His biography of the two men is called Remembering Reet and Shine, Two Black Men, One Struggle. And Michael Schwalbe joins us now. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So this is a book that turned out much differently than I think one you set out to write. How did you decide to write the book, and how did you decide to write a book about these two men?
I was actually working on a project having to do with fathers and sons. I was interviewing men over 65 about relationships with their middle-aged sons when I was introduced to Anthony Atwater and Matthew Mason, who were living in a public housing complex here in Chapel Hill. I was looking for a population of working-class African-American men. And I got fascinated with what I was hearing from them about their lives. Mr. Mason was born in 1911. Atwater was born in 1933. So these were two men who'd spent the larger part of their growing up in the pre-segregation, or segregated South, actually, pre-integration South. And I was just fascinated with what I was learning from them about what their lives had been like. I was drawn to their differences. I was fascinated by how their social circumstances were different from mine. And as a sociologist interested in inequality and race relations, this was a compelling opportunity to learn something I might never have learned any other way.
I want to pick up on, again, differences and similarities in these two characters, but before that, just Reet and Shine. These are more than just nicknames, right?
Yeah. With Matthew Mason, he picked up the nickname Dr. Reet from the fraternity that he worked for 50 years on the UNC campus. And that was, in fact, he almost was absorbed by that name, Dr. Reet. With Anthony Atwater, he was born William Burness Atwater, Jr., and as a young man was nicknamed Shine by one of his uncles. That stuck with him for many, many years. Later, he went through a series of nicknames, and toward the end of his life, he was known as Popcorn.
So similarities and differences. First, how are these two gentlemen similar, or how were they similar?
Well, both growing up in the South, working class backgrounds, struggled with many of the same limitations in terms of what was available to them by way of work, educational opportunities, treatment at the hands of the surrounding white community. The difference is Mr. Mason was older. He was of the generation of Atwater's parents, so he'd actually come off a sharecropping background and moved to Chapel Hill in 1924 to try to make a living in the city. Atwater, younger, faced a different time. Some of the restrictions that Mr. Mason had to deal with were loosening by the time Atwater came along, but not entirely. He was a man with great promise, great potential, and I think was tremendously frustrated by the limitations that he would have faced here, and was still, unlike some other black people of his generation, unable to get away and overcome that and succumb to some of the strains and pressures that put on him.
As a reporter, I'm always being challenged by an editor to explain why I should tell a certain story, why should they care about a certain story. Why these two stories? Is there something vastly different about these two gentlemen's stories, or were their stories emblematic of a particular time, you know, or place, or sociological question that you wanted to explore?
Well, it was both. When I initially met them and was thinking about the possibility of this biography, I was drawn to what was different about them, how their life circumstances were so different from mine. There was something there I wanted to learn about. And my initial thought was that I would write something like a social history of the black community in Chapel Hill using these two men's lives as the center points. But then I was more drawn into what was going on with them in their day-to-day lives as they aged, as they declined, and as they approached death. So in some ways, they were different. They were different from other men that I'd known, men of my grandparents' and parents' generation. And if not for that, I probably wouldn't have been drawn to them. But at the same time, as I got to know them and as I watched their lives unfold, I saw that the struggles they were dealing with were very much the same as many men in our society. So you're right in as much as they're different, they created these personas that they used to cope. And at the same time, they were very similar to a lot of men in our society who cope with the same strains of trying to live up to cultural ideals of manhood in the face of many limitations.
Maybe we'll hear from a little bit in, from the book after a break. But before the break, just I'd love you to explain how was this book different than a book you would normally write? I mean, what was different about this biography writing?
Well, normally sociologists don't do this kind of thing. I think you probably count on one hand the number of biographies written by sociologists. Usually we're great agglomerators, if that's a word, of data. But here I had an opportunity to write about real men, real people and concrete time and place, and write a book that would allow readers to connect. And so this was very different. I'd done profile short pieces for other publications, but this was an opportunity to try to understand these two men's lives in context. So the biography was a great departure from the kind of thing I would otherwise have written as a sociologist. But on the other hand, this is like any piece of narrative nonfiction with two people's lives at the core of it. And I guess I'm hoping that when people read it, they'll forget that I'm a sociologist, and that won't even occur to them.
I mean, just how much time did you have to spend with? You spend a considerable amount of time getting to know these guys and spending time with them, right?
Yeah, I spent altogether about 4.5 years with Atwater before he died, and about 6.5 with Mason. Originally, I was spending about an hour a week with them when I was just interviewing. But then as my life became more enmeshed with theirs, it was sometimes several times a week, early mornings, late night, emergency calls for various things, all kinds of help given under different circumstances.
So you went shopping with them?
Oh, took them
driving?
And there's far more of that happened than is reported in the book. There was a lot of shopping, running interference with bureaucracies, as they age and decline and living in low-income circumstances, they needed a lot of help.
We're talking with Michael Schwalbe, sociologist and author of Remembering Reet and Shine, Two Black Men, One Struggle. Coming up, more with Michael Schwalbe and Mama Dip's recipe for happiness in the new year. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking with sociologist Michael Schwalbe about Matthew Mason and Anthony Atwater, two working-class African-American men who lived in and around Chapel Hill. Both men developed personas for dealing with the hardships in their lives, and Schwalbe explores that in his book, Remembering Reet and Shine, Two Black Men, One Struggle. We're also taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Do you recognize the characters Reet and Shine in people you've known? Call us if you do, call us if you don't, and you have a question. Mike Schwalbe, I'd love to hear a little bit from the book, so tell us a little bit about a passage you've picked out here.
Yeah, part of this research involved looking at the white family out in Chatham County that once upon a time owned Mr. Mason's ancestors. So there was research not only of Mr. Mason's life, but of course extending back into the white families out there. In this passage, the name Tom Mason is mentioned. Tom Mason was a descendant of the white family from which Mr. Mason's great-grandfather had taken the Mason name. When he was a boy, Matthew's parents were sharecroppers in what was left of the old Mason plantation, and this is a fragment of Matthew's memory from that time. What he remembered: living in a frame house on the Tom Mason place, sharing an upstairs room and a double bed with his brother Charlie. He remembered cracks between the planks and waking up some mornings with frost on the wall and snow on the blankets that covered him. He remembered a cotton mattress on a metal spring bed and oil lamps. What he remembered: that Grandpa Fox was a happy man, not big, about the same size his namesake grandson grew to be. He remembered that Grandpa Fox didn't drink, but that Grandpa Dick did, and that his father drank, buying liquor for $1 a gallon at the government still down in the forks of the creek. Who ran a still there? The government, they said. Called it Ponto Government Still. People came from all around to get liquor there. That's all I know.
One thing I remember you writing about this is that you wrote or concluded that his legacy, that Matthew Mason's legacy of coming from people who were owned by other people or people who were beholden, affected him his whole life. How?
Well, it affected him in the sense that he was part of a whole category of people who continued to face economic restrictions, social restrictions, even after the Civil War. His family can be traced, his ancestors can be traced to the late 1700s out to Chatham County. That's as far back as we could go where there were reliable records. But for 50 years after the Civil War, his family continued to work as sharecroppers on what was left of the old white plantation. And when he came off that plantation, he faced the Jim Crow South. And at that time, there were very few jobs that a black man could get, and none of them paid very well. And that was true all his life.
What I found fascinating was the job he ended up having for most of his life, which in a way was rewarding because he developed a relationship that was kind of sweet and family-like with these fraternity members that he worked for. But on the other hand, it's completely paternalistic. There's something kind of ugly about it.
Yeah, and it's a complicated situation. There was real affection. There was real care that was part of that relationship. But it was within the limitations of what Matthew Mason could achieve as a black man of his generation in the South. So, yeah, there was some condescension there. There was paternalism along with the caring and affection, and that's why I say it was complicated. It's not all bad. It wasn't all good. Matthew Mason did the best he could under those conditions, and his children all went on to achieve very well. Most of them went on to college and had professional careers.
I'd like to hear a little bit, another passage that I think deals with Mr. Atwater. Before I do, though, I did want to ask you, just the passage you just read, I mean, a lot of it sounds like fiction. A lot of it sounds like a novel. It's very vivid, is that, I wonder how much of a challenge it was for you to write like that? Was this something new?
Well, it was new and it was old. It was unlike a lot of the academic writing I'd done around this time in my career. But before I went into sociology, my choice was between journalism and sociology. And so even as a sociologist, I think I've always strained to write in a way that was compelling and engaging and not desiccate people's lives to the point where no one wants to read what you've written. And so actually one of my sisters, after she finished the book, called me up to congratulate me on writing a real book. And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, it's not like those other books you've written, those sociology books. This is a real book." So it was a challenge and a pleasure, actually.
Right. Tell us a little bit about this passage you're going to read.
This is from Atwater's life when he was about 11 years old. There were some strains between his parents that I think will become apparent in this passage.
And again, he was Shine. He was known as Shine.
That's right.
Okay.
That spring, the boy's mother bought him a baseball glove for his birthday. Sometimes, on Sunday afternoons, the boy would play catch with his father before supper. It was late Sunday afternoon when his father, had he been gone since Friday night, came into the house and without a word began to take off his clothes to clean up. "What you been doing?" the boy's mother demanded of her husband. "I know what you been doing," the boy's father replied. The boy, always listening in fascination and fear, had heard these voices before. This time, when the yelling stopped, his mother was pinned to the floor, the meaty hands of a brick mason around her throat. She twisted beneath him, clawing at his face and gasping for breath. The boy saw himself take the fire poker from beside the stove and swing it into the side of his father's head. His father stopped, as if a switch had been thrown. Blood began to trickle down a line across the frozen man's temple. Then he looked up at the boy, staggered to his feet, and came for him. The boy ran from the house, still holding the poker, crying.
How would you say experiences like this would haunt Mr. Atwater?
They haunted him all his life. He was a child who didn't understand what was going on between his parents. There was a whole complicated story there, too, that's just barely touched upon in the book. But all his life, he regretted that incident, hitting his father. He did manage to escape his father on that occasion, but there was tension between them for years, and it was only later in his life, as his father was declining himself, that Atwater returned to Chapel Hill to take care of him, and he became, as he said, buddies with his father. But in his later years, Atwater, Shine, regretted that incident and many others when he mistreated his father.
How did you feel about these guys? Were there times when you didn't love them?
Well, I guess it would be fair to say that Mr. Mason was more lovable than Atwater. He was a warm, congenial soul and very easy to like. And even when Mr. Mason was frustrating, it was because of his own infirmities, and it was never because of his own stubbornness. Atwater could be a trial sometimes. Part of it was I got to see the best of Atwater. In his older age, he'd achieved some measure of perspective on himself. He was no longer drinking and drugging the way he had when he was younger, which often would set him off and put him into his his worst states. So I got to see the best of him, but he could be frustrating at times. There's one episode in the book, it's too long to relate here, when I was trying to explain to him in the nursing home why he was being billed the way he was, and he was just, it was like talking to a wall. But the ups and downs had a lot to do, my ups and downs had a lot to do with what was going on with them as they struggled with the health problems and whatever else was going on in their lives at the during the last years.
Has this book given you a taste for non-academic writing?
Well, I've always had the taste for it. I read a lot of nonfiction. I've been interested in this genre. And even when I've written more traditional ethnographies, I've always tried to write in scenes to bring the reality alive. And here, what analysis there is between the lines. It's reflected in how I've shaped the story and what I've told. And it's a kind of writing that I feel very good about.
Right. Do you have just about 20 seconds or so? What's your next project?
I'm working on a book about people whose lives have been changed by tobacco-related disease. People who've suffered, people who've lost someone, some farmers who've gotten out of growing tobacco because of health concerns, activists. That's the next book.
Our thanks very much to Michael Schwalbe for coming in. Michael Schwalbe is a professor of sociology at NC State and author of Remembering, Reet, and Shine, Two Black Men, One Struggle. Thanks a lot, Michael Schwalbe.
Thanks for having me.
Join us tomorrow on The State of Things when Frank Stacio talks to North Carolina musicians Fonte Coleman and Mitch Easter about the music that moves them.
I like those strings. I sound
well, you know, I've converted a number of people who have come into my studio to Scott Dumb.
I like this one ahead. That was hot.
Yeah, well, thank you. Comes from the man
upstairs. That's tomorrow on The State of Things. Acorns, pickles, and possums. The great tradition of the New Year's drop may have started in Times Square, but it's taken on lively variations here in North Carolina. This New Year's Eve at 7 p.m. on the corner of Cucumber and Vine, the Mount Olive Pickle Company will drop, what else? A 3-foot lighted pickle into a pickle tank. In Raleigh, as part of the 14th annual First Night celebration, the city will suspend its 1,200-pound copper acorn from a crane and drop it at midnight. That's in Licton Plaza in downtown Raleigh. And in Brasstown, North Carolina, the traditional possum drop is happening again this year. Festivities, including the Miss Possum Drag Contest, begin at 10 at Clay's Corner. And the possum, which may be dead or alive, you'll have to attend to find out, comes down at midnight. If you're passing through Virginia on New Year's Day, you might consider taking a break in Roanoke, Virginia, where you may see herds of runners there striding up Mill Mountain. The annual New Year's Day run is tradition in Roanoke. And if you stop for a meal in a southern restaurant, you may find a holiday tradition on the menu. Mildred Council, known more commonly as Mama Dip, has been eating the same meal on New Year's Day since she was a little girl. We visited her Chapel Hill restaurant where she told us what's on her menu and why.
New Year's meal is pork and black-eyed peas, collard greens, and we have yams. Yep.
Now, you call it a traditional New Year's meal, right?
Traditional New Year's meal because, see, we have it every year. I don't remember not having it since I can remember, and I can remember it, you know, since I was 4. Uh-huh. And now I'm 75, so we've been having it a long time. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is there a special symbolism behind any of the foods that you find in the traditional meal?
What my father told us and what his father told him about, it was a good luck meal, the hog head. Then we were cooking with a hog head, and then we come down to the hog jaw. Some people call it the hog jaw, but you don't find them there. And I do roast pork. The pork is to ward the evil away. Mm-hmm. And the collard greens is for dollar bills, the bill, the greenbacks, and the black-eyed peas are for change. Uh-huh. And that was it. So that's what you're looking for, you know, in the new year, because money, I guess, and good luck has always been the thing that you look for, you know, because I guess back then it was like when before we had the pesticides and all of this stuff to kill the insects, you know. They had a hard time. My dad had a hard time with his cotton sometimes because the boll weevil would eat it up, and then the cutworm would eat up the vines of tomatoes and kill them before they produce tomatoes, and all these things happen. So I guess that's how it come about. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you cooking anything in the traditional meal differently than it was cooked back when you were a child? Have you had to change because of ingredients or anything?
On my menu, I have things that's cooked with pork, and we didn't cook in the country. We didn't cook many things with pork because we didn't have pork much, you know. We cooked most with butter because we had the cow all year round. We had cows, and this is what I cook here. But the black-eyed peas and the collard greens, somebody ordered collard greens to take home, and they want them cooked with margarine. I do that, but here I let them know I got a sign on my thing that it is cooked with pork.
Is the traditional New Year's meal? Is it a big day in the restaurant?
Yeah. It's been a big day ever since I opened Mama Dips in '76, because actually people had forgotten about it. The traditional New Year meal. And in 1976, when I opened Mama Dips, that New Year, I had the traditional New Year's meal, and we advertised in the Chapel Hill News, you know. And so we had a crowd, and we've been having a crowd ever since then. But now some other restaurants, I think the Caroline Inn has it. Last year I saw that the Caroline Inn had that some other restaurant do have it now.
Do you have regular customers that you see every year around New Year's time?
Yeah. That's one of my joys is, you know, why I stay here so long, some days on the weekend during the holidays, like Thanksgiving, and just like now, a longer holiday. I see people that ate with me. They're bringing their kids back here to UNC, you know. They bring their children back here. And it's a joy to see them, you know, how they have grown up. And they look at how we're in the new building. And they say, oh, my God. They said, we sure miss the old place. The lady just left. She lived in New York. And she said, I sure miss the old place, but the food haven't changed, you know. Yeah.
Where will you be eating your New Year's meal this year?
Probably I'll be eating it at here. Because I got to cook. I got to help cook. I'll be in the head, Mama Dips.
That's Mildred Council. Her restaurant, Mama Dips in Chapel Hill, serves its traditional New Year's meal this Saturday, January 1st, 2005.